Soldiers of Persia, we have been deceived into attacking this holy city. Alamut has no weapon forges.
Dastan!
The weapons we found are forgeries. There are no weapons here, Uncle, and you know it. And the spy who supposedly intercepted them was hired by you to persuade all of us to invade Alamut. I should never have let the attack happen. But I knew in my heart that it was wrong.
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere like such as.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
This sucks, man. This stinks. I'm not filled with the usual excitement I have on recording days.
Right.
This feels like a chore.
Yeah. Well, shout out to JD for
big shout out.
Hey, we're gonna have fun here. We're gonna have fun here one way or another.
We're gonna have fun and we're gonna
goddamn
like it.
Family. Yeah.
Hey everybody. It's remember. Shut the fuck. I'm not sorry. It's, it feels so bad. How do we start the first one? Okay.
You do like a Prince of Persia intro where you've rewound the sands on the dagger in order to go to a time before you recorded the first attempt at this episode.
That's good.
Yeah, here we go. All right, everybody. It is our Sands of Time redo episode. Mm-hmm. Like many pods, we tragically have our first lost episode. We recorded an episode on video game movies and the file was corrupted. And here we are re-recording it for you. So I gotta say, we are not filled with our usual piss and vinegar. It fills us with dread at having to recapture the magic in the bottle.
And as JD said, we are now pressing on the Sands of Time button to go back before we recorded the previous one and recording with all the knowledge of what's going to happen on this episode. So hopefully it goes better.
Let's get going. All right. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Remember Shuffle. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Jordano.
Hello, hello.
And today we are joined by our all-time returning guest, none other than JD. Say hi.
Hi, everybody.
Listeners should be intimately familiar with your voice by now.
I hope not.
We're welcoming back the most doxed guest of all time.
That's right.
You may remember him from such doxed episodes as The Boondock Saints, Halo, Spike TV, and the Taking Back Sunday brand new episode.
Yes, a man of eclectic taste.
I'm flattered to be here. I heard your guest for the original recording of this, Dr. Henry Kissinger, couldn't make it. I am flattered to be in. I'm sure you'll be able to get him for something again.
Yeah, that was too bad. He had some very strong opinions on the Prince of Persia series.
Yeah.
He thought that we should bomb the fictional land of Alamut.
When the scene in Tomb Raider in Cambodia showed up, he was like, damn, I thought we got all of them. Yeah, what JD lacks in the pull of Dr. Kissinger, he makes up for in the fact that he doesn't have the blood of millions of Cambodian people on his hands. So that's a huge plus.
Henry Kissinger, when he saw Lara Croft kill the Vishnu figure, he was like, I thought we killed Vishnu while we were there. What's it still doing alive?
And today we're doing something a little new. We're taking a swing. We are talking about the phenomenon of video game movies, aka games to film, because these exploded in the 2000s decade and they range in quality from shitty to mid. They can rise to the height of mid. So there really isn't enough to do a full episode on any one of these films as we've done in the past. So we're going to do a little rapid fire. We're going to first talk holistically about what's wrong with a game to film. What do they get right? What do they get wrong? Then we're going to do little vignette snapshots, starting with Tomb Raider in 2002, moving on to Max Payne in 2008, before closing out the decade with 2010's Prince of Persia. So why are we doing this, Jordano?
Can you just say the word 2001?
2001.
Yeah, I might have to put that in for Tomb Raider.
Is it 2001?
I think maybe, yes.
Fuck.
Yeah, no, but that's why we got it.
There's a big difference between those 2 years. And,
if only we could use the time triangle to stop 9/11.
Or the sand. I'll use all the sand and the dagger to get into Seth MacFarlane's apartment.
And just wake him up earlier and splash water on his face. oh my God, this is crazy in the time I almost died in 9/11. Hey, Lois. Okay, what were we talking about? We're talking about this now because in the last 3 years, we've seen a lot of video game movies come out. And for the first time ever, we may have seen an inflection point where they finally realized how to make a video game movie so that they can be consistently mid.
You know? I would even say now they can almost rise to good.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at something like The Last of Us or The Witcher, they're learning. We're seeing people make good video game movies. And we'll talk a little bit about how they were able to figure it out. But in the 2000s, after an abortive attempt after the 90s Mario Brothers movie and then the Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat movies, they gave up for about 10 years. And in the 2000s, they are going through the slow, painful process of realizing how to make a video game movie. We'll get into why, but it's mostly just because they ignore some of the most obvious lessons over and over and over again. Like watching a baby learn how to walk and faceplant over and over again. And so in the 2000s, these video game movies are really like watching the original movies, like The Arrival of the Train at Chihiro.
I'm a big guy on a horse fan myself. You know, like from the 1870s, just a guy riding on a horse that blew everyone's mind. A thing that you could have seen anywhere. But this is the first desperate, halting baby steps of the games to film industry.
And so why are movie studios doing this in the 2000s? It's a painful process. So like, what is there to gain? Well, movie studios in the 2000s are on the search for recognizable intellectual property. But if films are now going to cost $200 million, they have to be guaranteed hits. No more flops. This means it needs to have a fan base that is going to show up. And one of the problems here is that we're running out of books and 70s TV shows to reboot. As a data science exercise, as the resident data science expert on the team here.
The resident evil, if you will.
Yes.
Very good. So, JD, take a guess at, of the top 10 films of the 1990s, how many were sequels?
The 1990s?
Yeah.
You said of the top 10?
Mm-hmm.
Four.
Two. Only two. Damn, Jurassic right. Park, The Lost World, and Star Wars Episode One. Both of these from the end of the decade, I might add. Mm-hmm. Now let's go to the 2000s. Seven of the top 10 movies are sequels. I mean, that is insane. That's a 350% increase in the number of sequels in the top 10. If you look at the top 30, there were only four sequels in the 1990s in the top 30 movies of that decade. Yeah, you add T2 and Toy Story 2. Now, when you look at the top 30 movies in the 2000s, 20 of them are sequels. We're going from four of the top 30 to 20 of the top 30. And so it's like a very hack thing to say, oh yeah, we got a lot more sequels or whatever. It's like, no, if you look at the math, it's so objectively true that hack or not, it's impossible to ignore this. We're talking about a five-fold increase in the number of sequels in the top movies. Between Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, The Matrix, Narnia, Pirates, Twilight, Spider-Man, Shrek, Batman, Ice Age, the decade is littered with these franchises. So, getting back to video game movies. If these studios are trying to minimize risk, it always blows my mind because it's like, what were they doing in the 90s, right? God bless the artists of the 20th century who were willing to take the risk on a new idea. What was going on here? Was it just ignorance or were they ignoring the profit motive?
Yeah, or was it idealism? I think the answer is neoliberalism. It's the consulting class getting more and more involved in movies. When you go to the IMDb or a Wikipedia for a movie, you'll see its budget and you'll see its revenue. And you might think that you can guess its profits from that. But a budget doesn't include marketing costs. So if you are trying to just shamelessly profit, maximize, cost, minimize, you want to save money on marketing to get people's butts in the theater. And I think there's probably a vicious circle that happens, right? If you're in the golden age of Hollywood, no one's adapting comic books yet. You're not making all these sequels, so you're not competing with other sequels. Everybody is making original screenplays. But once you get a whole bunch of consultants in there, a whole bunch of million VPs of this, that, and the other thing, and associate executive, whatever producers, there's this huge incentive to minimize your risk. And if you make something with a guaranteed fan base, it means you save money on marketing. And I think it also means you can probably cut some creative corners. Because one thing that we're going to notice is that these movies overwhelmingly are not good. You can do a bad job and still turn a nice, tidy profit. The movie-making industry is something that both Mark Fisher and David Graeber have written about, this neoliberal turn in movie-making in the 80s and 90s, about how, yeah, it's just filled with bullshit jobs, with people who get their name on the thing but don't really do a lot of creative work. This is what happens when accountants make movies, in short.
Yeah, and so these video game movies are still bad, but they have gotten a little bit better recently. Until 2019, no video game film, live action or animated, had received a Rotten Tomatoes Fresh score of over 60%. And three films have since: Detective Pikachu, The Angry Birds Movie 2.
It really built on what the first one did so well, I guess.
Yeah. And Sonic the Hedgehog have been able to break into the Fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And, you know, we're getting some really good TV shows based on video games recently. The Last of Us and The Witcher, maybe the first glimpse into what the genre could be. But the 2000s are the baby steps in the video game movie genre. Nobody knows how to do this properly. These films are all horrible.
Yeah, we could have just as easily done other kinds of adaptations. We're doing video games today, but there was just an absolute feeding frenzy for any kind of IP that's still going on. Whether that's video games, whether it's comic books. There was a period where they were adapting board games. So there was a Battleship movie in 2012. There was a Clue movie in the 90s. There was an Ouija board movie in 2014.
They've made several Lego movies.
So, yeah, we got the toy movies with Barbie, Transformers, Lego. Obviously, we have the fucking theme park ride cinematic universe with pirates. And then they had a Jungle Cruise movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson that came out recently.
Nice.
Anything that's even moderately recognizable, studios want to turn into a movie.
Yeah, I know. I mean, now we're even running through our product movies. The Air Jordan movie, the McDonald's movie.
The
Blackberry movie, which we just saw and we'll be doing an episode on because it rocks.
Yeah, did you watch the trailer for the Hot Cheeto movie I sent you?
I did not watch that yet.
It's a movie not about inventing the Cheeto, but specifically the flavor of the Flaming Hot Cheeto. The movie is called Flaming Hot.
Jesus Christ.
That's tough to hear.
It is hard to overstate the feeding frenzy that happened in the 2000s and is ongoing today. I think there's 32 video game movies that are currently in production as of this recording. Let's fucking go.
I can't wait for the Leisure Suit Larry movie adaptation. And that brings us to our next point, which is that recognizable IP is a finite resource. It's the oil to original stories' solar energy. You have to extract it and burn it. And you can only do a reboot every, 30 years or something. So it's more like...
Unless it's Spider-Man.
Harvesting trees. Yeah, unless it's Spider-Man. And so these video game movies are extremely popular. They have an avid fan base and an ever-growing one in the 2000s. It's not just children who play video games. At this point, you have guys in their 60s who have been playing video games their whole lives.
I remember in the 2000s just hearing this factoid that the average age of a quote-unquote gamer was 30 in like 2008 or 2009. So it was not just baby shit platformers anymore. As the demographic of gamer expands, people see a market that can be exploited. One thing that's kind of interesting about this episode is that we can look at how it all began. I said on our last episode that this was a hinge point decade for gaming, and this is also the hinge point for video game movie.
So, with that all being said, let's move on to what we'll be talking about in the episode more directly, which is why these movies were so bad and what is a common element to all of the video game movies of the 2000s and how they all miss the mark.
First, we're going to start holistically, taking the wide angle, diachronic view of a video game film, a game to film. What do they all have in common? And I think that across the board, games to film fundamentally misunderstand the strengths of their source material. So obviously, video games and movies are very different kinds of media that tell stories in different ways. I think of something like Ocarina of Time, one of the greatest games of all time, has fucking 8 temples that all have different mechanics, different items to solve their puzzles, to give the gamer that sense of exploration and reward, right? A game is based around a player's active engagement rather than telling a compelling story that you kind of passively observe from the outside. That's why a game like Ocarina of Time is so padded out with different puzzles and gear and challenges to keep you in engaged in gameplay for longer. But the thing is that video games do have strengths that should translate well to a visual medium. Video games have a particular visual style, and they frequently have their own worlds that have been built up that you can exploit. But we are not expecting a perfect one-to-one adaptation of source material, because that just wouldn't work. It doesn't have the, you know, three-act structure that we're used to. You know, I'm not demanding a fucking 10-temple Tomb Raider movie. But I would like to see some of the individual mechanics that made the games compelling reflected in this adaptation. So something like Tomb Raider was about platforming, puzzles, jumping, executing wildlife. There are three action scenes in the movie, maybe, kind of, when Lara Croft actually goes tomb raiding. Max Payne's main combat mechanic was bullet time. It's used precisely one time in the film. Prince of Persia had this amazing time manipulation mechanic where you can rewind time when you fuck up a parkour jump or whatever. And it's integrated into combat so you can freeze a guy in time and, you know, mess him up or whatever. But in the movie, it's this plot MacGuffin that's used like twice. And this happens time and time again. These movies don't understand what made the games great. They also don't really get the fundamentally lowbrow nature of the source material. No disrespect meant to the gamer community. Please don't Gamergate harass us. But there's a reason that the stereotype of the gamer is the horny, aggressive man-child. This is not highbrow art. I think that's starting to change now. I think games are getting a little bit more ambitious in the storytelling, but not these games that we're talking about today. So these movies want stuff with mainstream appeal. They want a PG-13 movie because that makes more profits. So all of these movies are PG-13, even if their source material was rated M for mature. Almost all of them. The ones that ascend to the heights of mid are the ones that do get the R rating.
Like Sonic. Ooh, the Conqueror's Bad Fur Day adaptation.
That's ooh, what we need. There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a movie. It's Sonic, but it's spelled S-A-W-N-I-C, and it's a Saw Sonic crossover. I want to play a game.
Maybe he has to not touch the rings that are in the room to avoid dying or something.
That's good. Yeah, he has to not collect rings.
Because yes, Jigsaw loves ironic punishments.
Right. Yeah.
So the result is, you know, less gore, less violence. All these movies are weirdly sexless. Even a movie like Tomb Raider, which is built around ogling Angelina Jolie, playing the pointy boob sex symbol, Lara Croft. It doesn't have a sex scene. It barely has a love interest.
And lastly, they all have something in common in that they do extremely poor characterization. Movie studios don't appreciate that most video games, and certainly not the ones we're talking about here, are very light on character and characterization. Think about Ocarina of Time that Ben just brought up. Name one character trait that Link has.
Pointy ears.
Yeah.
Hat. Tunic.
He doesn't mind getting yelled at a lot by Navi. Hey, because you're the character, you're playing as Link. And so the interactive medium of you being the character means that he doesn't have to do as much in the story. All of these movies fall extremely flat in adding characterization to the story. Lara Croft, Jake Persia, and Maxwell Payne, they don't add anything to their characterization. None of the fun mechanics, all of the bland character, please. So we'll get into that as we go through each movie. So these are the three overarching ideas that all video game movies from this era have in common that make them bad. And so for each movie, we will discuss the plot of the movie, what we liked about it, and what we didn't like under this lens.
And you will notice that it's going to be a very lopsided thing. We're really scraping the bottom of the barrel to find something nice to say about these movies, something competently executed. But a good friend of ours who listens to the pod complained that we're just too negative.
Well, he's a Florida man, and he likes to unwind, relax, and hear about good things in life. So we're trying to make the pod a little bit more positive for our one listener in Florida.
Yeah. We really didn't find a gem in this pile, even with the additional two movies that Ben and I watched between us.
Well, you guys said you liked Hitman, right?
But like, personally, I liked Hitman and Tomb Raider in a relative sense.
Yes.
In the pile of movies we watched. Tomb Raider is the one I'll defend the most, but I wouldn't say it's a good movie.
So let's start with Tomb Raider. The plot of Tomb Raider, such as it is, tells the story of Lara Croft, a British aristocrat / adrenaline junkie / archaeologist, the Tomb Raider, if you will. In the movie, she has to stop the Illuminati from acquiring a time triangle. They never say the words time triangle together, but they do say triangle about a billion times
it is a triangle that controls time. Because if the Illuminati find the time triangle first, they will use it to fuck with time. And if they do so, it will destroy the world. You can only find the time triangle, though, when all of the planets align twice in quick succession for plot convenience reasons. So they align, the first half of the triangle appears, then they misalign again, and then they align again, and you find the second time triangle, and then you can control time.
Makes no goddamn sense. But that's why it only happens every 5,000 years.
Yeah, it's so funny the way that the planetary alignment happens. Is it happens once every 5,000 years, and then double taps in a week later,
yeah,
and then another 5,000 years.
Yeah, we tried to get Neil deGrasse Tyson on this pod to explain the astrophysics of it, but he wasn't able to make it.
Yeah, he had a bad experience recently, apparently, so he's not appearing on any podcast.
Crazy news, though, he might be dating Taylor Swift now. In Tomb Raider, there's also a crazy exposition spoon-feeding the audience bit where every now and then they cut to the planets aligning. Yes. But the planets are all close together on the scale that would be like a child science fair model. Just in case the audience is too dumb to know that the planets are far apart.
Mm-hmm. It has just like so many goofy elements. It has the Illuminati, which,
hell yeah,
now that a significant portion of the population does believe in like elite societies now, we don't really have the Illuminati anymore as like a bugbear for like globalism.
Yeah, they did a good job with PR for sure.
Okay, finishing up this plot summary. Lara Croft's adventure takes her from England to Cambodia to Russia. The two halves of the time triangle are in Cambodia and Russia. And while this movie might be totally memory-holed from popular culture, when this came out, it was the highest-grossing female-led action film of all time. Sorry, Ripley from Aliens. And it was the highest-grossing film based on a video game. So what works in Tomb Raider? What do we like about this movie? Because I do kind of agree with JD that of the three main movies that all three of us watched, this is the best one. And I think it has to do with the fact that it's from an early enough period in the decade that they still got some of that residual 90s action movie sauce in them. They still know how to do it. Giordano and I rewatched Speed a couple nights ago from 1994.
It just like convinced us that the 90s really were this one song for great action movies, because it is the last time that everything had to be a practical effect. And some of that carried over into Tomb Raider. And so when the Illuminati storm Lara Croft's mansion and she has to fight them all using her home gym, which is like a bungee cord set up in her living room.
Yes.
Yeah. It all looks real and it looks great. It's a very fun and interesting action scene.
Yeah, Lara Croft's favorite hobby that she does right before bedtime. She puts on her pajamas. You know how you do maybe some yoga stretches before bed or whatever. Lara Croft stands in her 5-story atrium living room, attaches herself to indoor bungee jumps, and she leaps and poses and does ballet and whatever, and the Illuminati SWAT guys come down through the roof, so now everyone's on ropes. Have you ever seen a fight scene on ropes? Let's do it.
It's sick.
Yeah, this movie has a lot more going for it than some of the others. I think part of it is that it's the earliest movie we watch. I think it comes out in spring of 2001. Mm-hmm. It being spring is important. But yeah, I think it's not a great movie, but I think just a not great movie from 2000 is just automatically so much better than any movie from like 2009. Not literally. Good movies keep coming out. They always come out. But yeah, Tomb Raider, I think, has the correct amount of contempt for video games. One of you had said earlier that these movies don't understand how lowbrow their material is. And I'd say the ones we've watched, Hitman and Tomb Raider, both did. And I think that's what kind of is going for Tomb Raider. Tomb Raider is ready to go with just like tropes. Lara Croft's one character trait is that she's cool.
Yep.
Which literally is still more character traits than like the protagonist from at least two of our other movies. She's cool and it's fun. She's got a team of tropes that help her out. She's got a dorky science guy who drinks the soy coffee. He drinks the cuck coffee, the decaf soy, no fat latte.
They also have a cool butler.
No, he's not that. I mean, he's cool because when the house is under attack, he tacks up. He puts on a Kevlar vest and gets out a shotgun. But
yeah, he does the Lance Reddick character from John Wick, where it's like, oh, he's just silently being badass. And then finally, I think in like the second movie, don't, because I kind of hate John Wick.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a gun out and you're like, oh yeah, we always knew he was a badass too.
Mm.
And it's sick when the house gets invaded by the SWAT team, who, by the way, are done up like video game mooks with glowing green eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome. Mm-hmm. The butler hears the commotion and you're like, oh no, what's this also kind of soy butler gonna do? What does he do? He puts on huge soft body armor, grabs a shotgun, and heads on out. It's awesome.
Yeah, but he doesn't get there in time. Lara Croft handles everything on her own.
In a sweet motorcycle action scene.
Yeah.
Where she's driving a motorcycle around her own house.
Yeah. Also, the butler, I don't know, I don't think the butler's as badass as JD says, because the only thing that we see is that he's really obsessed with how Lara Croft dresses. She doesn't dress ladylike enough.
Yeah.
At the climax of the movie, this is the extent to which Lara grows as a character at all. She puts on a dress to visit her father's grave.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And this butler is so happy that she's changed her clothes to dress like a respectable lady.
Master Wayne, I wish you'd wear a dress more.
One day, Alfred, you'll see me sitting across the terrace and I'll be there wearing a dress.
That's my wish for you, sure.
At least the characters have one dimension, I guess, which is more than the other movies can say.
Yeah.
Listen, we can't give you a pyramid, but we can give you a line. That's what we can do. One dimension.
There's a point when they almost do platforming. Mm-hmm. There's a bit where she does have to jump, she has to solve a puzzle in the Cambodia segment, if I recall correctly. It's a boring puzzle that I don't feel like describing, but she does jump on a moving stone platform to make stuff happen. So ding, ding for that. It's got that. It has a Disney-style gay villain, like Ian Glen.
Yes.
Better known for playing a pedophile knight in Game of Thrones. And he's young, and he's good at it. It's a
Wait. Sir Jorah Mormont or whatever is a pedophile?
I mean, he's into Daenerys, I guess, right?
She's like...
The story opens with him being a beta orbiter to like a 14-year-old.
Yeah. Yes. No, Ben, he's right. You're doing the anime, like, in the story.
I didn't remember how old Daenerys, because she's not 14 in the TV series.
In Essos, the age of consent is clearly stated to be 13. Yeah, that's a very good description of the villain. He's a Disney-style gay villain, like Jafar or Scar.
Yeah, he's incredibly effete. Every time we see him, he is somehow always in a permanent state of lounging. When he first meets Lara Croft in England, he's at this ostentatious colonial Indian themed area. He's lounging on a fucking palanquin or whatever.
Yeah.
Might as well be smoking hookah. Then we see him again at the dig site in Cambodia, and he's had someone set up a mobile lounge for him so that he can always be head rested on one elbow. Even when he barely escapes the collapsing Cambodian temple, he gets back to it, just starts lying down, putting his feet up again. He's just truly languid in this film. And he chews up the scenery. He's having some fucking fun with this. And all of the action set pieces, like the temple in Cambodia, is pretty dope. It has some horrible CGI where a giant statue of Vishnu comes alive and Lara Croft shoots it in the face. The temple in Siberia has this enormous model of the universe that, like JD described, could be like a child's science fair model that they go platforming over and people get knocked over by the rotating planets.
Oh, that does tie in. Yeah, that does tie into the weirdly out of scale space shots that they do. Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, the action scenes rock. And listen, accent aside, I think that Angelina Jolie gives it her all in this dumb movie.
She does.
Yep.
And she is like 1999 type of cool. This was definitely made after The Matrix.
She's certainly trying harder than Jake Gyllenhaal and Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, she is like oozing charisma. She's a 25 in this movie.
Okay, I gotta walk it back a little bit.
No. Okay. That's not okay. Okay, walk it back because I don't want to describe a woman as oozing ever. okay, but no, walk it back. Pause. She's got a ton of charisma. Come on. She's actually, and I'm not just calling her hot. No, she does. They give her one character trait, and that's to be cool. And yeah, I don't really know Angelina Jolie's work well. I haven't seen a lot of her movies, but she pulls it off, especially for like a 25-year-old. I wouldn't have known how to act like anything at 25. I understand they're actors, but like, I don't know. Like, and I'm not joking.
I got to disagree a little bit, and maybe we can transition to what doesn't work / what is bad about this movie, because I think it's going to start with the character of Lara Croft. Like, she has two looks.
Sorry, Lara?
Yeah, there's no you there.
I think it's Lara. It's not me. It's Lara David. Like Larry David.
Oh.
He's Tomb Raider.
I gotta go in there?
It's filthy. What are you, nuts?
This time triangle is pretty good. What's the bathroom situation in Cambodia like?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess Lara Croft and Lara David have a similar amount of money in reality and in the fictional universe, which is one of the more annoying traits of Lara Croft, is that she's a rich aristocrat.
Yeah, she has two looks and maybe 50 lines of dialogue in the movie, because she spends most of the movie, like JD said, just looking cool. But her two looks is a smug, self-satisfied smirk that comes from her being amazing at everything. And the other is a purse-lipped, panting, horny look anytime she exerts herself in any way. Which, again, it's a very sexless movie, but this is where they want you, the viewer, to use your imagination, right? This is a very Victorian kind of sexiness.
Yeah, so she's just this beautiful, emotionless robot. She has no flaws, emotions, or internal motivations. This is what we mean by like a one-dimensional character. She's just awesome at everything. There is no internal motivation for anything she does beyond some like vague duty to her dead father. But she's got the booty shorts, she's got the tank top, the dual wielding hand cannons.
Yeah, she's got the giant gold belt buckle with a skull on it to show you that she's badass. But it does kind of recall the SS skull. And I was watching this with my German roommate, and he was like, "Whoa, wait a minute. That looks kind of familiar." She is a British aristocrat. You know, they dabbled. They dabbled with the Nazism.
Yeah. And she's awesome at everything she tries to do in this movie. She's an expert marksman. She's an expert motorcycle driver. She's an expert at parkour. Anytime a foreign language pops up in the movie, she's able to speak it, including both Cambodian and Russian. And she's just able to instantly recognize puzzles and supernatural mysteries in an instant.
This was the angriest I got in the movie. They're in the final temple in Russia, and she sees a CGI shimmering in there, and a dog leaps through the shimmering light and gets deconstructed into muscle, bone, and sinew, and then as it passes through the light, gets reassembled into a dog. And Lara Croft just says, "Ah, it's a time storm. Time is broken here." How do you know that?
I love that. It was so ridiculous for her to know that I was like, well, yeah, it's all right, though, because she's Lara Croft. She studied the stuff. She's raided a tomb or two in her day.
What is a time storm?
There are very few things in the English language that don't get funnier with the addition of time before this.
Would that this hoodie were a time hoodie?
So her character, right, Lara Croft, she's equal parts Indiana Jones, in that she does archaeology, tomb raiding, interactions with the supernatural and ancient religious context, and Batman, in that she's rich and lives in an 83-room mansion with various kinds of servant henchmen and does indoor atrium bungee jumping. But I don't appreciate how like insanely rich she is, and maybe it's just a product of the time, but Croft Manor is quite literally the same house as used in the 1989 Batman. And every time I just imagined her raiding one of these tombs, I imagine her saying, "It belongs in the British Museum."
Tomb Raider is very, very an apt title, because she is not not a science type archaeologist. She's a tomb raider. Like, her father has stuff stolen from other countries, you know? So I think Tomb Raider is very apt.
It's true. Yeah. I don't see her very concerned about the stratigraphy of the site, you know, making sure that the levels of dirt don't get contaminated or whatever.
Yeah. She destroys every temple she walks into.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the three comparisons that we have here, Indiana Jones, Batman, and James Bond, each of these figures has deeper characterization than Lara Croft in that they have some kind of flaws. Indiana Jones is kind of an everyman, right? And he has daddy issues by the time we get to the third one. Batman has his childhood trauma that he works through by dressing up like a leather bat and beating up poor people. Even James Bond is a guy with a job. He's a lunch pail guy. He clocks in, murders some union organizers, and clocks out, you know? And even then, when you get to dark, gritty reboot Casino Royale, he is also a guy with some trauma, right? Ain't no fucking trauma on Lara Croft. She just rocks, man. Get with the program. Which I think is actually a flaw of the movie, rather than JD, who sees it as a strength.
Yeah, and that "it belongs in a museum," that's the last line from the cold open of the third Indiana Jones movie. And it's meant to characterize the type of guy he is, right? Which is like, I want to see historical artifacts from from the developing world in a museum.
Listen, at the time, it was better than in rich guys' private collections.
Right,
it's funny
right.
how the goalposts have shifted.
Yeah, true. Right.
Rich guys' private collections, like Lara Croft's body. Yeah. Exactly the person.
Yeah, we're not privy to any of Lara Croft's internal motivations about why she raids tombs.
No. Daniel Craig says she's only in it for the glory. I'm in it for the money. Right?
Right. She wants to be on the front page of National Geographic, I suppose.
Archaeology magazine.
Uh-huh. Speaking of James Bond, yeah. We have like a 31-year-old Daniel Craig in this movie.
Ah, yes. Yes. Perfect segue.
Like the worst American accent.
Yes.
Tomb Raider, the movie where everyone but Daniel Craig is British.
Yeah. The movie where everybody does the opposite accent, yeah. Right? We got John Voight doing like a half Irish, half Scottish, half English accent. He's really piling everything into it.
He's doing an accent I like to call leprechaun stroke victim.
You got Angelina Jolie who's doing like Jenna from 30 Rock style camera.
Yeah. She gets right up to the line of 1940s transatlantic of saying, Tom, I'm sure.
And you have Daniel Craig who's doing a horrible American accent. We'll put a clip in.
I suppose you think I'm a greedy, unscrupulous sellout and do just about anything for money.
Yes, that's right.
Well, the money bit's true, I guess. Now for a cold shower.
Egregious. Yeah. Another thing that's not so great, something we talk about with almost every movie we do on this pod, the Bechdel test. This female empowerment lady action movie fails all three of the tests for the Bechdel test.
Just, that's so few. It's 0 out of 3. The Entourage movie, I did 2 out of 3 at least. The Entourage movie. And this is the highest grossing female-led action movie of all time. 0 out of 3. What the fuck? Oh, this movie, as far as ostensibly being a female empowerment movie, just missed the mark so badly. Because one of the funniest details about the production of this movie is that the gamers criticized Angelina Jolie's casting by pointing out that her boobs were not big enough. They were mad that Lara Croft did not fit the body standards of the game, which no human being does on the planet. Her waist is the size of her arms in the game. And the studios heard this backlash from the fans and we're like, we hear you, we see you, you're beautiful, your concerns are valid, we will make her wear pads in her bra. You poor babies. That's the one area where they stayed faithful to the source material.
Well, two, technically.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Mostly they were like, she's got to have bigger boobs. It doesn't make sense without that.
People can believe a reanimated Vishnu statue, but a hefty C-cupped Lara Croft?
Right, yeah, she was only a C, and they demanded that she be a D.
Mm-hmm. Another problem with this movie is that I think everything other than those three big action set pieces are so, so, so boring. There's a scene that takes place in Venice. They go from Cambodia to Venice on their way to Siberia. And what do they do in Venice? They just have a conversation in an ostentatious room. Lara doesn't really have that many lines, so mostly it's people talking around her, and like this boring conversation in a Baroque Rococo room is supposed to be this big emotional reveal that actually Lara Croft's father was in the Illuminati, and like, man, I don't care. I think they kind of try and split the baby. Like JD says, Lara Croft is cool, and this movie is about looking cool and swagged out, and that's it. But they do try and add some emotional heft and weight to the movie, and it just totally falls flat. Like this plot line about, oh, the Illuminati and her dad and blah, 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 blah. Oof, do not care.
Her dad is dead, and so the scenes that we get with her and him are either like her dreaming about him or her having some flashback memory. It's just really hard for us to believe in this emotional bond, considering her dad is just not in the movie in his actual form at all.
Now that you mentioned, I'm pretty sure that's the point when they drop the dad plot line. Is about a third of the way through the movie. Does he ever come back?
I don't think so.
No, she has a conversation fascination with him using the time triangle, the climax of the movie.
Mm.
You know, you've heard of the rule show, don't tell. But this movie goes a different route, which is neither show nor tell. There are some very funny lines about why Lara does what she does. Like I already said, Daniel Craig says, Lara's good, but she's not great. She's in it for the glory. I'm in it for the money. Meanwhile, most archaeologists are tenured professors who use undergrad labor to dig up literal trash heaps in an attempt to find a slightly different style of pottery.
And for a movie that features Daniel Craig ripped as shit and Angelina Jolie in booty shorts, it's a surprisingly sexless film, maybe because of the PG-13 rating, but we never once see her use her sexuality or have sex or even flirt really once in the movie, for a movie which also has a romantic plot line with Daniel Craig. It's very odd.
Yeah, it's very clear to me the reason they didn't do this is that these same horny gamers would implicitly be like, it should have been me. That's my video game girlfriend.
And honestly, thank goodness. I think that might be one of the strengths of this movie, is that in its hour 40 runtime, it doesn't waste time on that. For a movie that was marketed pretty much entirely on, like, hello, folks, we're going to sexualize 25-year-old Angelina Jolie. Come see this movie. Right down to the awful poster where her head is just on like a fake Tomb Raider body. The movie, thankfully, basically doesn't deliver that much on that. She is sexy in that she's like, hey, look at this competent ass athletic woman doing cool stunts in a nice outfit. But it doesn't really sexualize anyone much beyond that. And you know what? I didn't need that in this movie. And so I kind of liked it. Like, she is, at least 51% of her character is cool, and 49% or less is hot as far as the writing split goes.
You're right.
Nice.
And yeah, this movie just needs to take itself less seriously, right? Because it's kind of made to be realistic. We don't see any magic appear until 40 minutes into the movie. And in the game, Lara Croft shoots dinosaurs and bears and all sorts of tomb creatures.
Yeah, at a certain point, Lara Croft just starts executing gorillas. Started attacking you. Like, we could have had Harambe on film in the year 2001.
Just have some fun with her shooting some dinosaurs. Enough of these flashbacks of her dreaming about her dad.
Freudian reading. Lara Croft has these giant dual-wielding handguns, right? The Freudian context. The hand cannons are obviously dicks. We were watching a hot lady handle two penises when she unloads. Sometimes a cigar is not just a cigar.
If you wanted to look at the guns, those guns with like the huge like compensator barrel extension on the end as sort of a phallic symbol, I think you could. But I would disagree with you and your interpretation. Well, I could agree that the guns could be viewed as sort of a phallic symbol. I would disagree in that Lara is not subservient to them. She's not jacking them off in a way that's pleasuring the gun in any way. The guns, in fact, face outward and serve her in her purposes of killing things, shooting wildlife, or like a cool Boston Dynamics robot. And in that way, she could be said to be wielding both the feminine, you know, she's Angelina Jolie, she's 25 years old, bouncing all over the place. But she also wields the masculine in the power of the gun. And if you would, the phallic symbol of the gun still holds, but in that she holds it as her own power.
Hell yeah, dude. Love
it. I got a cool book about females and chaos that
Yes, there it is. So yeah, closing off our section on Lara Croft Tomb Raider. Both these Tomb Raider movies, because there was a sequel, Lara Croft : Tomb Raider / The Cradle of Life, they made tidy profits of over $100 million, and they would have made a third, but Angelina Jolie walked away from the role and didn't want to play it anymore. And I think this has to do with them trying to treat video game source material as serious and not leaning into the campiness. So Jolie walks away because this is pubescent boy shit, right? Which is hilarious because she'll still do comic book stuff. She's in both Wanted, that came out in 2008, and recently she was in the fucking Eternals. But comic books were able to make the transition from nerd culture to something with mainstream respectability in a way that games to films clearly could not. I think probably that largely has to do with the fact that Christopher Nolan is a competent filmmaker, and he's able to be like, look, superhero movies can have themes. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, this is for adults. This is for adults and teens.
True, yeah. We need the video game movie Chris Nolan to come about.
Right. Okay, so we're going to jump forward in time to the year 2008 to discuss Max Payne. And we're going to start with a quick summary of the game and film before saying what we like, which is very little, and what we didn't like. So this one really hurt because I think we all love this game so very much as youths. Max Payne, the video game, is equal parts neo-noir and John Woo movie. So you play as Max Payne, a renegade cop with nothing to lose. You go on a rampage through New York in a blizzard to discover those responsible for the death of Max Payne's wife and daughter. The game features this slow down time mechanic called bullet time, obviously taking a huge cue from the Matrix. You slow down, you dive through the air, you shoot, you see the bullets whiz by in slow motion. Mm-hmm. And what starts out as this very basic revenge kind of plot line, it turns into this huge conspiracy going all the way to the top surrounding the drug Valkyr, because Max Payne's family was killed by some Valkyr junkies. And it turns out it goes all the way up through big pharma and the government and everything.
Much like noir, yeah, it typically does. It involves some kind of state and corporate corruption.
Mm-hmm. So this really should have been the easiest, lowest hanging fruit for a movie adaptation because the game is so highly fucking cinematic. Instead of cutscenes, it has these graphic novels with these voiceovers. It has this really well-developed character because we get Max Payne's internal monologue throughout the entire game. He gives the noir voiceover.
Right.
And he has so many metaphors.
I came in from the cold and the dark. Outside, the city was a cruel monster. I've been slowly working my way from the small time to the big fish, trying to get to the source of the drug. Alex and BB were my only contacts in the DEA, the only ones in this decrepit city who knew I was down here.
For them to fuck this one up is really such a much greater sin than the other ones. I just played Last of Us for the first time yesterday, and It's so perfectly adapted to TV because half of it is a cutscene, mm-hmm. right? Like it does feel like you're watching a story with characterization. And Max Payne works the same way. Half of that game was these graphic novel cutscenes, and Max Payne is extremely well characterized mm-hmm. as this sarcastic, funny, black-pilled man. Nothing to lose.
Yeah, the game cover had police caution tape on it that said, "Caution, renegade cop with nothing to lose," or something of that nature. And the movie stars Mark Wahlberg as Max Payne, and it just jettisons all of that. Instead of being like a wisecracking guy, he's either quiet and sullen or just yelling in his stupid Mark Wahlberg way. The movie is just totally bland and generic that hits some of the same beats. It still involves Max Payne trying to avenge his family. It still involves this Valkyr conspiracy. It still features some of the characters, even though they're barely recognizable. But none of the things that I described in the game that were great, the neo-noir feel, the bullet time, the well-characterized Max Payne, none of that is there at all.
Yeah, and just to focus on structure here for a second, we're supposed to talk about what we like about the movie first. And this nothing. The first point here is almost nothing. There is one bullet time scene, and it's him like shooting a shotgun behind him. It's just not something you would have even done in the game, really. It's horrible that they took the most memorable part of the game, which was the bullet time shooting, and did that one time mm-hmm. in the film.
Poorly.
Yeah, poorly. Insane.
That little sequence is a mess. It's hard to tell what's happening. It pissed me off.
I'm really scraping the bottom of the barrel here, but I think that this is accidentally an ACAB movie because every cop in this movie has Dora the Explorer levels of problem-solving abilities. So the plot surrounds this drug, Valkyr, named after the Valkyries. And the Valkyr junkies tattoo Valkyrie wings somewhere on their body. One guy has it on his forearm. A different guy has it on his face. It's also literally the logo of Acer Pharmaceuticals. And there are multiple shots of different cops, including a confused-looking Mark Wahlberg, looking at crime photos of the wings, being like, "What?
Do you see any pattern here?" Yes.
I bet a classicist could have gotten to the bottom of this like that.
This is because I said your last name on the pod one time, isn't it, JD? And yeah, to show you just how big cucks the nerds are, IGN, the video game journalism site, awarded Max Payne the best game to film of 2008. They gave the shit an award. I remember in that actual post itself, they were like, "Yeah, it's not great, but the award is relative." So we got to give it out to somebody. And that's something good about it. It demonstrates how pathetic the nerds are. So With that being said, let's transition to what's bad about it. Do you know how bad a movie you need to be worse at being a movie than a video game is? Like I said at the top of the show, these are two different media with two different, you know, victory conditions. A video game has different metrics for victory. But the Max Payne video game that you can watch on YouTube, you can watch a playthrough and it's 4.5 hours long if the player is really good and never dies. That 4.5 hour YouTube clip is a better Max Payne movie than the Max Payne movie.
I thought it was interesting too with that Last of Us that the first episode is almost a direct scene for scene remake of the video game. That's something that Max Payne did not opt for at all.
Yeah.
No, and it's the one probably movie that we watched that could have just done that. Did we talk about the plot? I guess we did. It's a boilerplate rampage movie.
Yeah, with a pharmaceutical like neo-noir intrigue story about how the Valkyr company is actually selling this illegal drug. You know, it's about the Sackler family.
And eventually they do, I think, blow up the fictional tower in Manhattan, which is like one of my favorite movie tropes. Max Payne is a movie where Mark Wahlberg once again fails to prevent an explosion in downtown Manhattan. Skyscraper.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a rampage movie, but he doesn't shoot anyone until like 40 or 50 minutes into the movie. In the same way that it took Lara Croft 40 minutes to raid a single tomb, this one is even more boring than Tomb Raider. Mark Wahlberg's Max Payne barely talks. Real life Max Payne's chatty as fuck.
He's constantly speaking to himself and making jokes.
We come to you now live from the crime scene.
Who is this?
Right back at you.
This is Deputy Chief Jim Bravura from the NYPD. You are to cease your criminal activities and surrender immediately.
Sure thing, Jim. Me and the boys have been talking and everyone's real sorry. They'll never do it again.
Who the hell is this?
Being placed at the scene of a bank robbery wouldn't have tipped the odds in my favor.
Yeah. Also, how dare they cast a famously Boston guy as a New York City detective? It's like having an Israeli play Muhammad, which would be controversial for many reasons.
Yeah, and one of the great things about this game was how true to the New York City of the 90s that it was portraying. I remember playing this and like the subway looks like the New York City subway system and like, it gets the architecture of the buildings right. And it really has that feel like you feel like you're in the Lower East Side or the East Village of Manhattan in the 90s. And the movie has the fucking gall to be filmed in Toronto. At one point, Ben yelled because the fucking streetcar tracks from Bloor were visible. And he's like, come on, man. Everybody knows New York doesn't have any streetcar tracks. You dumb. Like, it sucks how much they eschewed what made the game great, which was like portraying sleazy New York City of the 80s and 90s, something that the original Rampage movie did very well, Death Wish. And so I'll never forget as a kid just seeing how disgusting these mobsters were in the game, right? Having disgusting sex with prostitutes in this 80s, 90s neo-noir sense in the crack epidemic era. And the movie has none of this. A movie that actually gets that much better is the Boondock Saints movie, which JD also came on the podcast for. Like Ron Jeremy's character being in the Peep Show would have fit so well in the original Max Payne game.
And you know where that movie was filmed? Toronto!
Yeah, also a movie with visible streetcar tracks.
They did a better job of portraying New York City in the Boondock Saints. And that's a movie that's filmed by a moron in the same city than in the Mark Wahlberg, Max Payne movie.
You got to drop that that Family Guy. Toronto, it's the city where they film the scene set in New York.
Yeah, and the movie is just generally ungritty. The game was so like cynical and gritty. Max Payne pops painkillers instead of health packs, right? Because he's dead on the inside. He just needs to make it through. Shit, man, they could have just hired John Woo. They got the tone so bad. Has to be neo-noir with a John Woo Hong Kong action film. Just mash those two things together and you'll get it right. But this movie goes so off the rails with tone that the junkies hallucinate Valkyries. God damn. Right?
Every time they did one of these hallucinations, I wanted to just leave the house and jump in front of a train. They were so bad. And they did it over and over and over again.
Get it? When they do Valkyrie, they see no
Nordic angels.
And you, the viewer, see their hallucinations, like, pull them out of windows at the top of high-rise towers. The movie has this, like, almost wannabe supernatural tone, and I remember this was featured so prominently in the trailers. Trying to trick people into seeing this movie? Yeah, let's talk about the drug Valkyr in this film.
Oh my god, listen, as a drug enthusiast... Watching Valkyr in this movie is mind-numbing because it only just makes people terrified. There seems to be no good part of this drug. Everybody who takes it immediately gets psychotic and terrified. Why are so many people recreationally doing Valkyrie? It makes sense that your withdrawals would bring on a sense of psychosis and fear. But while you're high on it, presumably should be good.
It should be enjoyable in some way.
Yeah, right.
In the game, these junkies would spray paint like a skull and crossbones, but the crossbones were syringes, right? This is meant to be a hardcore drug that fucks you up. And then it's only when you're in withdrawals that you get paranoid and violent. Valkyr in the movie is cough medicine. It comes in a little vial that you drink.
We couldn't even go as far as show people shooting up. I'm sure the MPAA has some very specific stuff where they were like, okay, to fit it into the rating, people have to drink the Valkyr like it's like a shooter.
In the movie, it is eventually revealed that this was made as part of the U.S. War on Terror. This is one major difference between the game and the film, the game which came out before 9/11. In the movie, it was made to turn soldiers into super soldiers. And it was a real high-risk, high-reward thing because 99% of the people who took Valkyr lose their minds. Go insane, paranoid, they see the Valkyrie angels. But the 1% got to be super soldiers. And there is a scene, like an exposition scene, where they interview a soldier and they ask, how has Valkyr affected you in the War on Terror?
Yeah, it's the closest thing the movie, for a moment, edged to almost having a compelling villain. The scene with the testimonial from the bad guy is kind of sick. I think he did a good job. He's actually scary in that scene. They're just asking this Marine, like, hey, what was killing people like? And he's just like smiling and being like, felt awesome. I can take on the world, man. Mm-hmm. And now, for some reason, I don't know if I can put on the guy's performance or what. I actually found that scene kind of scary and compelling. And then Max fights that guy for 2 minutes and he dies. And that's that's the rest that they use that character for.
And wouldn't you know it, very predictably, towards the climax end of the movie, Max Payne has to take the drug Valkyr himself because he's about to die of hypothermia. So he takes the super juice. And wouldn't you know it, our special boy is a special boy. He does not lose his mind. He's part of the 1%. And he's able to use it to fuck up his enemies. In the game, when you took Valkyr, it led you into a platforming hallucination in which you need to walk down a trail of blood and deal with your traumas. Far better than the movie.
Thank you for bringing that up, Ben, because that is something that the movie does omit. That was an infamous part of the actual game, was that the action will be interrupted for these too hard, not that interesting platforming sequences through Max's dreams and hallucinations. And that there was no super monkey ball walk a line platforming sequence in this movie. And in this one case, it was a strength to not have things from the game in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, another movie that ruined by its PG-13 rating. You can't have all the violence and disgusting mobsters and drug use because of the rating system. And one of the worst features of this movie, I think, was the way they shoehorned Mila Kunis. I never thought I'd be like so unhappy to see Mila Kunis on screen. But this movie, I managed to do it by just having one of the worst, flattest characters of all time. We have no idea who she is in this entire movie, what she wants, or really anything. She kind of just shows up and starts pining for Mark Wahlberg. Mm-hmm. And
she's avenging her sister.
Okay. And
because the Valkyr addicts or something tore her limb from limb.
It was Jack Lapino. It was the scary Marine who knifed her to death.
They had the time to just dismember poor Olga Kurylenko in an alley.
I think so, yeah.
That makes no fucking sense. That character, who, by the way, is a stock character. Okay, this is a whole thing. That character is played by Ukrainian actress Olga Kurylenko. And she plays, and I'm not saying this in my own words, a character that could only be described as Russian prostitute. Right? And that's the character she plays. And she's immediately killed. And that kind of kicks off the story. Another movie we watched, Ben and I watched, Hitman, co-stars Olga Kurylenko.
She got typecast.
Yeah, she. That's a crazy thing to be typecast. She's doing stuff like Annihilation now. But yeah, we are supporting Ukraine because Ben also watched Resident Evil with
Mila Jovovich. Jovovich.
We are a pro. I'm putting this on record. We are a pro-Ukrainian podcast. Support their thin, waifish women.
Mila Kunis in this film plays Mona Sachs, who was a real character from the game. She was a contract killer who works with Max Payne to take down the enemies. And again, she was a noir femme fatale who talked like a noir person and just not there at all in the movie.
Yeah. And then we get Meg Griffin coming in here with no motivations of her own.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. The second time she appears in the movie, it is as a disembodied voice and it is a little distracting. It is a little like Meg shouting at Max Payne.
And the last thing I'll say before we move on to our last movie, the little Norse mythology touches. There is a whole bunch of little Norse references. So obviously the drug is called Valkyr, like the Valkyries. The evil pharmaceutical company is called Acer, which is like the older generation of Norse gods, if I recall correctly. And then there's like a club that's called Ragnarok. That's like a big level. And all of this shit is there and you can figure it out. And it's thematically appropriate. This is Max Payne's own personal Ragnarok. It's his end of the world. It's an epic snowstorm, which is part of the Norse mythology, how the world ends. But it's the end of his own world. It's so good. In the movie, there's a tattoo artist who just gives a spiel on Norse mythology, and we'll put that in post because it's obnoxious.
That's a Norse Valkyrie. Vikings used to wear them for protection. Valkyries fly over the battlefield, picking out the righteous dead. They reward the people who draw first blood. A soldier's angel. In Norse mythology, the only way you get to go to heaven is to die in violence. You die in your sleep, you go to hell.
They were icing on the cake in the Max Payne video game. They never spoon-fed you. Man, the game had a defter touch with the reference, had more respect for the player than this movie has for the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bad. You have to actually try to fuck something up this bad.
It truly so incredible and impressive that they managed to ruin this story because it was served to them on a silver platter and they just took out all the parts that were good and they focused on the parts that were not good.
Yeah. So. Yep. What do video games have? They have world building and they have lore and they have specific visual styles. Let's ignore all that and focus on the flat characters. Right. And not even flat in the case of Max Payne. Let's flatten a good character. Okay, last thing I'll say about Max Payne, then we'll move on for real. Max Payne in the game is an undercover cop. That's why he knows all of the mobsters. Uh-huh. That's why he's dead inside. He's been playing this game, getting close to some of the grimiest, greasiest, sleaziest people in New York City, right? That's where his cynicism comes from. He has seen the dark underside of the American experiment. Max Payne in the movie, desk jockey.
Yep. Works in the evidence room where he doesn't talk to anybody. And it's like, what sounds like a more interesting tableau for shenanigans? An undercover cop or a guy who works at a desk in a basement? All right.
One star out of five.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the movie, it's tepid. And that's the worst thing about it, is it's just, it's not even fun, aggressively bad. It's just tepid.
This next film might be worse, honestly. Because at least Max Payne, for all of its faults, was like a tight 95. And yes. Prince of Persia is 2 hours long.
Oh, Maron, what a fucking stinker we got here for you folks. Oy vey.
The Prince of Persia.
We're taking a trip to the exotic Orient.
All right, Prince of Persia, colon the Sands of Time, tells the story of Prince Dastan, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, adopted prince of ancient Persia. And there are two plots in this movie, one that deals with a succession dispute, you know, a brother-uncle conflict, classic, and one plot that has to do with a supernatural dagger that can speed up or slow down time. And this actually overtook Tomb Raider as the highest-grossing video game movie of all time. So we got two of the heaviest hitters from the decade summarized for you on this episode. And it's also a Jerry Bruckheimer swashbuckling movie, which should tell you everything you need to know about what they were hoping hoping this movie would be cough, pirates, cough. Yeah, let's run that back. A period piece, some action adventure. We'll have some bits and some bants, a little bit of supernatural. Call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
Keep shitting those out. I don't want to go into the nitty gritty because this movie is fucking bloated. It's 2 hours long. That's the gist of it. And what you need to know is that eventually the prince, played by Swede Jakob Gyllenhaal, successfully does prevent another time apocalypse. It is kind of funnily the same plot as the time triangle from Tomb Raider 2. If the bad guys use time travel, it will destroy the world. So the good guys need to...
We want to go back in time in all of these movies. We want to go back before 9/11. Back to the 90s.
We want to time travel back. We'll awaken, surrounded by lightning, Terminator rules, naked, in Seth MacFarlane's hotel room.
Wake him up.
Yeah, make sure he gets on that plane.
Yeah.
You can go back and make sure Mark Wahlberg's plans didn't get changed and that he gets on that damn plane.
I thought you were saying that about Seth MacFarlane. Like, he was the, if I was on that plane, it wouldn't have gone down like that. Ooh.
That turned Seth into almost Obama at the end.
Look, folks, if I was on that plane, it wouldn't have gone down like that. Just saying, me and my friends from Hawaii were on that plane. Who knows? We wouldn't have put up with nonsense. I can tell you that right
now. Yeah, that would be Barack Hussein Obama's role in 9/11.
Oh.
All right, let me try a Seth MacFarlane impression again. Look. If I was on that plane, it wouldn't have gone down like that. I don't know, Peter, if I was on that plane, it wouldn't have gone down like that.
You're getting there. You're getting there.
Yeah, that's good.
My name's Seth MacFarlane. Damn, I can't
get out of Obama.
Yeah, shoot. Seth MacFarlane is just Brian, right? Like, Brian is Seth MacFarlane's normal. He's got a lot of spunk on her neck. If I was on that plane, it wouldn't have gone down like that. That's, I guess, my best Seth MacFarlane.
Nice. Yeah, so let's do what's probably going to be the hardest part of this entire episode. What is good about The Prince of Persia?
So for one, the first 20 minutes or so really teased me. Mm-hmm. This had something that I think Max Payne didn't quite have, which was an action scene with motivations and platforming.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie opens already with a child parkour chase scene. The Prince of Persia was what they call in climbing a kid crusher, a child who can climb 10 times better than you.
Mm.
And, using his escape skills and whatever, he manages to gain the respect of the king of Persia and becomes adopted son. There's 5 minutes of plot and then another protracted action scene where the Prince of Persia has to help his brother's armies and stuff capture a city. And in order to do so, there's the whole sequence where he does platforming and he does parkour. And there is a visible goal that is shown, not told in this scene, which is he's got a wonderful bit of PG-13 violence, by the way, where for whatever reason he sees, gosh, there's too many of the other guys and they're going to crush my brother's armies if they make it to the city gate. And he sees a classic medieval pot of boiling oil suspended above the gate. And he's like, if I jump from here to here and cut this rope and whatever, again, shown not told, he can get the oil to fall down. And in a wonderful bit of PG-13 violence, he achieves that. But instead of it dropping on the guys and, having them all die horribly, it drops in front of them, making a wall of fire that makes all the bad guys go, whoa!
Yeah, and I think someone even shoots the oil with a flaming arrow and it goes kablooey, right? Mm. We hear like a Wilhelm scream.
It's actually a reasonably good little action sequence that contains shit from the game. There might not be a wall run, but there's definitely a paddle dino or two where he's jumping from corner to corner on these on these buildings.
Yeah.
Just to summarize the plot for a second, it's a sort of a uncle intrigue movie in that it's the story of a royal family. Jake Gyllenhaal's adopted is one of the three brothers who are set to inherit the throne. When suddenly the king of Persia dies and it gets passed to his son, but actually the uncle has been plotting to take the throne for himself.
The king of Persia is assassinated and Jake Gyllenhaal is framed for it, right? That's an important part of the plot.
Yeah, and so Jake Gyllenhaal is on the run and needs to find a way to uncover the true killer, which is his uncle, played by Henry Kissinger, what's his name?
Ben Kingsley.
Ben Kingsley, yeah.
Yeah, Ben Kingsley had so much fun playing Gandhi. He was like,
Let's do that again. Let's play someone from the exotic Orient.
Right. And yeah, he meets one of the world's most annoying women of all time and bands up with her. And they have a I hate you, I love you type relationship. And they eventually, you know, restore order to the kingdom of Persia.
Yeah. There's a wildly underused time travel mechanic. In the course of the movie, one of the brothers dies, but they are able to use time travel to essentially make everything go back to how it was before. So no one died. Not the king, not the brothers, nobody. We're all safe.
Mm-hmm. Just to wrap up what's good about this movie, you know, we mentioned that the opening action scene is all right. The Alfred Molina character I thought was great in that he had attributes that would make him saying things true to his character, which is how characters work and why they're funny. It's like why we love Jack Sparrow. Because he acts like Jack Sparrow. And Alfred Molina, he plays this sort of free market libertarian scoundrel who hosts legal ostrich races and complains about taxes all the time. He's sort of like an ancient Persian Ron Swanson character.
An ancient Persian anarcho-capitalist.
Right, yes.
Like for actually, though.
And so whenever he's beguiled into doing something with promises of gold, it's kind of funny because we know that he's sort of greedy and hates state authority.
Yeah. All right, well, that was our quickest section ever. Let's transition to what is bad about this movie.
Oh, my God.
Let's get back to characterization, which is something we've been talking about all episode. I cannot stress how brain-melting it is that they made a $200 million movie and no one ever thought to ask, hey, what traits does Prince Dastin have? What does he want in life? You know, compare this to Pirates as an exercise, which is based off of a theme park ride. But if I ask you, what is Jack Sparrow like? It's easy to describe that. He's a rogue trickster who's just lucky enough and charming enough to survive by the skin of his cheek.
And probably an alcoholic.
Yes. Yeah, that's another trait. Will Turner. He's loyal and duty-bound to a fault. He believes that the world is fair and his hard work will lead to a better life. Trying to do this for Prince Dastin, impossible. $200 million, we can't answer this basic sentence about the film. He's kind of like Jack Sparrow in that he has all of his confidence, but without any of Jack's selfishness that makes him a funny heel. Mm-hmm. And he's also like Will in that he practices swordplay every day, but without any of Will's naivety about the world. He has all of the strengths of the characters of Pirates of the Caribbean without any of the weaknesses.
Yeah, all of our video game protagonists are just these absolute fucking ubermenschen. They can do everything. They don't have flaws. They just have incredible strengths.
And weaknesses are way more important attributes than strengths because the character's fallibility is what makes them interesting most of the time. When Alfred Molina gets tricked with a promise of gold, that's funny because it's a weakness. It's not just that he's awesome.
Yeah, Alfred Molina's character is so much fun than any of the actual main characters. I'm convinced he just ad-libbed or wrote his own dialogue.
Alfred Molina, who played Dr. Octopus in Spider-Man 2, by the way.
Also, yeah, talk about Jake Gyllenhaal for a second.
Oh.
This man is descended from Swedish royalty, and he's wandering around the deserts of Persia. Yeah, $200 million budget. Could we get someone who looks even vaguely Persian?
Yeah, and like he can still be white. I'm not saying, the movie was ruined by the fact that they cast a white actor in a non-white role. Like, it's certainly not its strongest point, but it's not going to ruin the film for me, except that they cast this blue-eyed, blonde-haired guy, and he's wandering around the desert wearing a headscarf. It's so fucking distracting. Cast a Jew, cast an Italian. I like come a little bit towards the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Jake Gyllenhaal's family is descended from Swedish royalty. So it doesn't make any sense that he's in the desert. And he's so Swedish and so aristocratic that his dad is a member of a religion called Swedborgian, which is literally a 30 Rock joke that Jack Donaghy says about the richest people in the world.
Insane.
Ben, earlier, you called this a period piece. And I did want to ask you, what period are we depicting here?
I'm glad you asked, JD. So obviously we don't expect historical accuracy from the Prince of Persia movie, but this is nuts. This is every period of mildly recognizable quote-unquote Eastern history all mashed into one. So at the start of the movie, we have this map that shows you, you know, Persia. I'm sure we have like a sitar and a ululating call to prayer in the background, as Hollywood movies always do when we're in the East. And we have this map that shows Macedon and Greece and Persia. That is a specific moment in history. That puts us before like 333 BCE or so, if Macedon hasn't come down. That is a specific historical moment. I can make a minor pedant point in that it shows Rome having, you know, unified the entire Italian peninsula, which wouldn't happen till later. But whatever, you know, fine. I'm not going to be a pedant about the map too much. Then we hear a lot about gods in the plural, pointing towards pre-Islam. Persia was famously, of course, Zoroastrian, and we don't hear anything about Ahura Mazda or the other one, Ahura Mazda's nemesis. We don't hear anything about the prophet Zoroaster. And when we have these tracking shots of eastern cities, we see so many minarets and domed mosques, which has to put us after Islam. So like late 600s, early 700s. There are a few lines where it's like, oh, you heathens and your gods, plural, which points towards some monotheistic polytheism strife. You have the Turks name dropped at one point. They don't come onto the scene until the early medieval period. You have the Mughals of the Hindu Kush get name dropped. They're from the 15th century. And then at one point they go to the lair of the Hashasins. Thanks, Dan Brown. When are we? What year is it? Dan Brown actually has a better grasp of history than this movie. There's even a whirling dervish in the Hashasins lair. It's just all over the place. So to answer your question, JD, when and where does this take place? I would say it takes place within a racist 19th century Frenchman's painting. That's where and when.
In episode 2F09, when Itchy plays Scratchy's skeleton like a xylophone, he strikes the same rib twice in succession, yet he produces two clearly different tones. I mean, what are we to believe that this is some sort of a magic xylophone or something? Boy, I really hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
Ladies, gentlemen, and the non-binary, I have been owned.
No, I mean, I make that joke just because it's a perfect Simpsons reference, but the movie is all over the place. That's kind of what makes pirates fun, right? It's set in the age of piracy. It doesn't need to be perfectly historically accurate, but that era is very romanticized and fun to go back to. And I thought that, I guess you could do the same thing with Prince of Persia, but you have to have a clearer idea of the era you're trying to romanticize.
It takes place in sword times.
Yeah, well, once again, we have Jake Gyllenhaal doing a mediocre English accent.
And when
we were watching this, my German roommate once again was like, why is he English? Jordana was like, it's the past.
The American accent wasn't invented yet. Yeah, that's an awesome quality of any movie that's supposed to be over 100 years old is you have to have a British accent. And yeah, I mean, the whitewashing in this film, we can take a second to mention that Ben Kingsley, Jake Gyllenhaal, Alfred Molina is at least Italian-British, but come on, guys.
Ben Kingsley played Gandhi.
Yeah, and people criticized him in the 90s for that. This is 18 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
And just getting back to our initial points about how these movies have to work, it's insane the stakes of how a blockbuster movie works. Because this movie made $336 million on a $200 million budget. And so the profit difference is pretty similar to the ratio of money from like Tomb Raider cost $115 and made $274. But franchises have to be so much bigger and bigger and bigger to be successful that you can make a $336 million flop. You planned on making sequels and making another Pirates universe, like for Jerry Bruckheimer. And it's like, oh, no, it only made a third of $1 billion. Complete financial disaster. As Ben put it in our Reddit guy episode, the economy works and makes sense.
We only made a third of $1 billion. We will never financially recover from this.
It's interesting you guys pointed out, I didn't know this, that Jake Gyllenhaal was some kind of royalty, because this is a monarchist movie. The ultimate goal of the movie is to get the good king back in power. There's not an end to the monarchy or anything. In the climax of the movie, the prince of Persia gets a hold of all the time sand, and he uses it not to go back before they conquered the city that turned out to be good, or to maybe stop his brothers from
doing the Iraq war.
Yeah.
Yes, from thank you, from doing the war on terror of the city. No, he goes to right after they won that battle and won the city to expose his uncle's betrayal.
Why should we care who's in power if it's Jake Gyllenhaal and his brothers versus his murderous uncle? Why should we as the audience give a fuck which of these despotic family members is in power in this kingdom?
Well, Ben Kingsley has a goatee, so he's bad.
Uh-huh. That's what's fucked up, is that as the audience, I feel like it's written where we're supposed to understand the dad king is a good king, and that's the ultimate win end game state of the movie, is they've reinstalled the king that's good in this monarchy where they've just captured a city and forcibly married off its princess.
Right. And we're not saying that every movie has to like endorse some kind of rights of man, French Revolution style, but it's a swashbuckling movie. It shouldn't be about stakes like that. Pirates of the Caribbean works as a swashbuckling movie because it's about the fates of a single guy. And to introduce geopolitical stakes into a swashbuckling movie makes no fucking sense. And we make these jokes about the war in Iraq, and those aren't jokes. These are explicit references in the movie that seek to draw a parallel between the unlawful invasion of the kingdom of Alamut by Persia.
Yes. So in the opening scene of the movie, they're debating whether or not to invade the city of Alamut. And Ben Kingsley's wicked uncle brings swords. He says they've been exporting swords. They have edged weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, they're like special swords or something.
Yeah.
They're like Valerian steel, unobtainium, plot metal swords.
And sure enough, Persia invades and conquers Alamut. And wouldn't you know it, there are no weapons forges. And this is a recurring plot of the movie where the good brother spends the entire film scouring Alamut to try and retroactively prove that the invasion was in fact just.
Saddam Hussein does have the Sands of Time.
Now we're lucky. He has the sands, but doesn't have the dagger. he's got to put them together.
He's got enriched.
So it's like, yeah, just this weird ham-fisted political message where like, yeah, Ben Kingsley is evil because he's like Dick Cheney. He tricked us into going to war or whatever the fuck.
This is a quote from the movie. I'll put it in post, but our allies, this is Ben Kingsley speaking. Our allies must see our invasion was just. The search for weapons remains important. Yes, but what if there are none? The invasion of Alamut was a lie. Then Tuss is after power. He searches not for weapons, but for sand that fuels a mystical device. Remember what the Pirates of the Caribbean movie had to say about the war on terror? By the way, in the three movies we just talked about, both of the video game movies that took place after 9/11 had to explicitly talk about the war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Another thing that sucks about this movie is the female lead is awful. Oh. They hate each other, but they have to work together and they backstab each other. She is just like this, it's like nagging wife. Their banter is so bad. Here's an example. You enjoy telling me what to do, only because you're so good at following orders. Don't push your luck. Terrible. I think maybe they want to secretly promote Wahhabism. Maybe this is their goal. Maybe they want me to think, oh yeah, those morality police in Saudi Arabia, they're, you know, they're not so bad. That's a joke. I support the women of Iran in their protests.
Yeah, they want this female lead to, at the same time and alternately, be both a super competent warrior priestess that can be in the action scenes, but also when it's necessary to be like, woo, a bug, whenever it's convenient for the plot. She also has no traits.
And this is all the more galling because the original Prince of Persia game actually had a really well-executed love story where they had a similar conflict where Farah, the love interest, was some kind of priestess of the sands and needs to begrudgingly work with you, the prince. Sidebar, in the games, the prince doesn't have a name. He's just the prince because, once again, it's a video game. The player is you. But they begrudgingly work together. They slowly fall in love. And just like in the movie, the climax of the game involves running time back to before they knew one another. And the game has this bittersweet ending where Farah does not remember falling in love with you, the prince. And so she remains hostile and antagonistic, and the prince needs to depart, and they don't end up together. Whereas the movie has everything I said, except for the end where she's like, you know what? This guy who can control time, we clearly fell in love in the past that I don't remember, so he's cool.
Yeah. Because this movie has an interesting relationship with consent, I think. Because as Ben pointed out, yeah, at the end, he gets access like all the time sand, and he uses it to go back to just after the battle where they've conquered the War on Terror city. Now, in the beginning of the movie, part of this conquest they do is that the female lead is forcibly under duress betrothed to the prince's brother. So the whole plot of them falling in love happens completely under duress, because I think Gyllenhaal, the prince, I think as he's escaping after being framed for his father's murder, does he bring her with him as a hostage? Or she is his captive, is she not? So basically the whole movie, she falls for him under a situation that is completely under duress to begin with. But yeah, you know, she falls for him and that's fine. She has agency. She can fall for this dude. But in the climax of the movie, he uses all the time sand to go back before they met and, you know, fix everything. And in the final end game of the movie, because he did just such a good job, the prince, his brothers, when the repeat of that scene, are like, you know what? This hot priestess shouldn't marry me. She should marry my cool brother, the Prince of Persia. And she is, in the end of the movie, also under duress, betrothed to the Prince of Persia. And we're supposed to accept, like, oh, you know, they fell in love. And she, you know, spoiler alert, she knows the time magic. Well, that's her function in the story, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so you can tell, oh, she knows. She knows that the Prince of Persia did some time magic to fix everything. And so we, the audience, are supposed to be like, of course they're going to fall in love. But the events of the movie haven't happened. She's just been betrothed under duress to the Prince of Persia. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of the movie, is that she is a captive betrothed to the Prince of Persia in his War on Terror murder kingdom.
Yeah, much like how Max Payne the video game is a better movie than Max Payne the movie, the Prince of Persia video game has a better meditation on love than this $200 million Disney movie. To repeat, I know we're going to sound like a broken record on this one, but just not understanding the fundamentally awesome mechanics of what made this game good. So there's very little parkour, very little problem solving. They use the magical time dagger 3 times, none of it in an action sequence. We get to see Jake Gyllenhaal like unload a camel in reverse or some shit like that. Some totally dreary and monotonous thing. But this was a key part of the game. The movie has 3 moments of this. It stinks. Also, the Prince of Persia games had skeletons and demons and stuff. It was in this very supernatural context. Oh, sorry. I'm getting frustrated. 3 moments of time travel in a 2-hour movie. Absolutely egregious. And it's weird that they jettisoned a lot of these fantasy elements to try and make a more quote-unquote grounded or realistic version of the movie, because see above for my anachronism rant, they were neither grounded and realistic, nor were they fantastical. Just, again, just totally splitting the baby in half. Not doing great.
So, just to wrap up this episode, we'll do a quick summary of some of the other video game movies that came out throughout this decade, including Resident Evil, Hitman, and Doom. So, starting with Resident Evil.
Yeah, let's do it. I love the Resident Evil video games. They're glorious in their campiness, right? These games come from Japan, especially the early ones. They got terrible voice acting.
Now it's Wesker's time to disappear. I don't know what's going on.
Well, it can't be helped. Let's search for him separately.
Okay, I'll try the door on the opposite side.
And Jill, here's a lockpick. It might be handy if you, the master of unlocking, take it with you.
Campy writing really leans into the B-horror side of things. And that's not to say that they're not scary. They're a survival horror game. The fear comes from some good jump scares that happen. The fear really comes from you, like, managing inventory. You're in a spooky mansion filled with zombies, and you need to watch your ammo. In the first game, they limited how much you could save with these ink ribbons. It was an item that let you save, so you had to be judicious with your saving. Super campy. You're in a haunted mansion that has an aqua ring with zombie sharks underneath. Like, remember in Austin Powers where they had sharks with lasers on their heads? You go into an aqua ring with waist-deep water so that you can fight zombie sharks, but not actually have to incorporate a swimming mechanic so that you can still walk. The main difference between the Resident Evil movie and the Resident Evil video game is that the Resident Evil movie takes itself much, much, much more seriously. It's a very claustrophobic and intense movie. Instead of being in a spooky mansion, they're in this facility 1 mile underground that's been taken over by a rogue AI. And also there are zombies and also there are creatures. Stars Mila Jovovich kicking ass. And honestly, it works. JD, what are your thoughts on the Resident Evil movie?
This was the first R-rated movie I watched out on my own with the other kids.
Heck yeah.
I'd felt so guilty about it that I ended up getting admitting to my mom that I had done it. I remember I watched the movie before I ever played a Resident Evil game. And yeah, I had no idea, like, oh, this is campy and it has like a silly, goofy element to it. Hmm. But there are some cool sequences I remember that none of these movies have ever done, especially the infamous laser scene.
Yes, that's yeah. Rough.
Hopefully we can drop some good Resident Evil dialogue drops in here. Scooter, give me that Sadler, your small time drop.
Sadler, why don't you give up and let Ashley go home?
Perhaps you are disillusioned with overconfidence just because you killed my small time subordinate.
Sadler, you're small time.
RE4 is one of my favorite games ever.
Oh yeah, Resident Evil 4 is perfect. But yeah, the Resident Evil movies, they made 6 of these before they rebooted the franchise. God. They made 6 movies starring Mila Jovovich. And before some recent movies, like I think that the new Super Mario Bros. Movie made $1 billion. Until recently, this was the most successful games-to-film franchise. I'm embarrassed to say, I think I watched the first 3 of 6 as a youth back in the day. But man, it works. It's perfectly functional. It's not winning any awards, but it's got the R rating. It's got the cool universe. It's got the cool style. And they added a character. The Mila Jovovich character, Alice, is not in any of the Resident Evil games. They didn't do Chris Redfield or Jill Valentine or any of the campy voice acting player avatars that we know and love. They added character, and the movie thrives because of it.
And for Hitman, you guys said that it was probably your favorite adaptation of the decade, right?
Yeah.
Because it sort of was the most faithful to the spirit of a video game in that it was kind of a stupid, fun, ridiculous movie.
Yeah, it is a dumb guy movie through and through. It starts Timothy Elephant as Agent 47, the Hitman. It's got the R rating. It's got the superfluous violence. The Hitman games are great because they have these open worlds that let you be creative, and they prioritize replaying, trying to find the most outlandish and ridiculous ways to assassinate your target. There's a scene where this international cabal of assassins has sent assassins after Agent 47, and they all slowly walk onto a train car holding dual pistols at each other's heads. It's like a, you know, Mexican standoff. And Agent 47 just goes, "Gentlemen, how about we die with some dignity?" And he reaches into the small of his back behind his suit and pulls out 2 mini katanas. And then they have a close quarters katana match. It's just, it's dumb action guy shit, and it leans into the campiness. It leans into the over-the-top nature of the source material. Yeah, it works.
Yeah, it's still not strictly a good movie, but on the scale that we're on, it does kind of rock, because it has enough contempt for the source material, not the source material of Hitman the game, but of video games in general, that it is just fun and ridiculous. There's, what, probably 3 different times that Agent 47 uses some sort of costume. The first half hour of the movie, he's taking orders from the computer lady voice. Like, okay, you're in the video game. It gives you the feeling like you're in the video game. Okay, Agent 47, you must kill the guy. But then he gets fucking burned or something, if I recall correctly. And the computer has betrayed him, and he fucking slams his Hitman laptop down. Bam! I feel like symbolically, that's the moment in the movie where it's like, video game's over, folks. Now it's movie.
Yeah.
Hitman's making his own missions now.
Also, we gotta throw in, he attempts to assassinate the Russian president in one of the early scenes of the movie, and the movie implies that this president was assassinated for being too moderate, which is a thing that happens.
It's a great Russia bad movie. Almost every movie we watch actually does have at least a kernel of Russia bad in it, but this one really makes a whole plot of it. One thing Hitman has is that the Hitman and the female lead actually have great chemistry in this movie. Much like Tomb Raider, Hitman is portrayed like he's very sexless, which at least is true to the character. And as a male character who's portrayed sexlessly, he's kind of almost innocent. He is this dangerous, very masculine coded in many ways, but he's completely sexless and innocent. And at one point he even, Hitman has an interesting relationship with consent. But at one point, you know, at one point he drugs the female lead to prevent her from having sex with him.
Yes.
But in general, it actually really worked. The female lead is played by Olga Kurylenko, who unfortunately was typecast as, I can only say, like, Russian prostitute. Including in Max Payne, by the way. She is the same woman who was dismembered at the beginning of Max Payne, also playing a Russian woman who was, say what you will, use whatever old Hollywood euphemism you'd like. Anyway, it actually works, though. This literal prostitute and this innocent, sexless man chemistry, it fucked rock. Yeah. I actually loved watching them together.
Hitman, I think it is a dumb guy movie, but I definitely had the most fun watching it out of all these movies.
And that's all we want at the end of the day. We're trying to have a good time, okay? Listen, I don't need it to be The Godfather, but it should at least be The Boondock Saints.
Yes, 100%. And yeah, Doom. Giordano, you watched some of Doom, right?
I watched some scenes from Doom, yeah. And again, it suffers from not understanding what made the game great.
What made the game great was space hell. Yeah. The concept of space hell.
Exactly.
Space hell is a cool concept, right? Warhammer 40K does space hell. The dangers of space and the dangers of demons together? Well, we just raised the stakes here.
Space always lends itself to existing genres very well. Space westerns, mm-hmm. space Game of Thrones. And then this one, we get space hell. And we don't even see any of these space hell monsters again until like 40 minutes into the movie. They do a very awkward yet sort of adorable homage to the game by having an extended first person action shooting sequence and at least being like, hey, we're doing the thing like Prince of Persia does with the parkour scenes. But yeah, another sort of miss on the way to making competent video game movies.
One of The Rock's only flops. You know how hard it is to make a movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson flop?
And so to wrap this all up, this whole episode, we want to just talk a little bit about the echoes in the culture, because these movies were all the Dieppe raid. Lessons to be learned and to be ignored on the way to making a good video game movie. So video game movies coming out now seem to respect the source material a bit more. And I think that Sonic may have been a very interesting turning point in video game movies, because they released a little bit of Sonic in trailers and fans fucking hated it, right? Mm-hmm. His eyes were weird. He was in the uncanny valley. Fans made a big deal, and Sony actually folded to them and redesigned at great financial cost. And he came out looking a lot better. I thought that they embraced taking the source material a lot more literally.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonic collects rings in the movie. And nice. He lives in his fantastic checkerboard loop-de-loop jungle world. I think that they took this input from gamers and made a movie that they actually wanted to see.
Even something like The Last of Us, they took a game that was already so highly cinematic, like you could criticize it as being an interactive cutscene. And yeah, they just had respect for it and they made it. And when they deviated from the source material, like with that famous third episode that everyone loved and cried over, it fit. It fit with the tone of the game. It fit with the story of the game. It used a character from the game and fleshed it out. They are finally starting to get it. And I don't think it's any coincidence there are now 23 video game movies in development.
Yeah, we are going to be seeing a lot more of this, folks. Including a Phoebe Waller-Bridge Tomb Raider series for Amazon, which I'm super intrigued by because I just don't understand how Fleabag mixes with Tomb Raider, but I'm very much interested in seeing how that works out, you know.
It's a heist movie, but Lara Croft is stealing from the British Museum and returning things to their country of origin. Yes,
she's the museum raider.
Well, yeah, one interesting way that I think there's been an echo of video games in movies in the culture is that we're now looking at film, like movies and TV, that are inspired by video games without even being about video games. Because now we're living in an age where the people who write and make our television and our movies, just as a matter of existing, have all been exposed to and immersed in video games.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one example of a really successful show recently is The Mandalorian, is a video game.
Yeah.
The Mandalorian has taken the things that are addictive, the gameplay loop of video games that keeps people addicted to them, and have made it a show where in each episode, the Mandalorian and perhaps some sort of crew fight a boss, get an item, and then he, at either the end of that episode or the beginning of the next one, will get a new weapon or piece of war gear from the Mandalorian shop master character. And we get excited.
What are you buying?
Yeah,
what are you selling?
So Mandalorian is going to use his new missile pod or his new jetpack or his new piece of armor to then fight a new boss, like the evil AT-ST or like a big monster or something, and get a new cool item and use it in the next episode. And that that is video game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. That's part of my closing thoughts here is we are kind of heading towards the singularity of culture where I think a lot of our boundaries between media are starting to be eroded. So yeah, TV is starting to look more like games. Games are starting to look more like movies. Miniseries are starting to look more like movies. Movies aren't really starting to look more like TV, but I think in a lot of cases, we are heading towards this point of singularity, and it acts as a kind of feedback loop, where now it's much easier to make video game movies because video games have started to look more like movies.
And I think movies are starting to look more like TV in that they're much, much longer. Yeah, and I think some closing thoughts that we didn't mention is that maybe we're starting to see good video game movies because studio execs are at an age now, they're Gen X people, who might have actually played a video game growing up and really liked them and had beloved memories of these Super Mario characters, right? I don't think Jerry Bruckheimer has ever played Prince of Persia. I'm just going to go ahead and say it without an alleged.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine that man ever having played that game.
I do imagine he does that thing that boomers do when they play, where when they jump, they move the controller, like their whole body.
Yeah.
When he does something. All right. I think that's all we got for you today. Our retrospective on the late 19th century film equivalent of the video game movie. This new exciting era of the IP feeding frenzy that we're entering right now. So as I always say, if you joined us, thank you for listening. Like, subscribe, tweet at us.
Yeah, if you want to support the show, we don't have a Patreon or anything, but our favorite thing is when people take a screenshot of them listening to the pod and post that to Instagram or Twitter. It warms our heart. So if you'd like to do that, thank you very much.
And we will retweet or share.
Yeah, right? And we love reposting it. We just posted our Sims episode and we had someone post a visualization of the Andrew Tate expansion pack that we were joking about on that episode. So shout out to El Cid for that one.
Yes. And as always, thank you so much, JD, for coming on the pod. It's always a pleasure to have you, bud.
Yeah, likewise. It's my pleasure.
Hell yeah. All right. If that's all we got, ciao, ciao.
Bye. It's my Max Payne. Bye. It's me, Seth MacFarlane. Creator of Family Guy.
Yeah.